Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and you're listening to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to drive giving. QBAC's proactive, personalized approach to engagement helps you build your major gift pipeline even in a time of social distancing. QBAC's AI-driven system uncovers actionable insights about alumni interest and connections and automatically delivers them to advancement professionals for use in cultivation. QBAC is a force multiplier for development officers, enabling them to focus on what they do best, developing deep relationships with individuals and converting them into active donors. Learn how to raise more money with less by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. I would also like to tell you about Responsive Fundraising's training. If you are looking to align your team around a shared understanding of effective fundraising, let's talk about our four frameworks. If your culture doesn't feel right, before you begin any significant planning, launch a capital campaign, hire another member of your team, let's ensure everyone is on the same page. How about inviting us to be on site with your board, leadership team, volunteers, and staff for your next planning event? If you'd prefer a virtual seminar, we can do that too. Let's get your team thinking more critically and carefully about the road ahead. Shoot me an email. I'll also put some information in the show notes. Hi, Brian. Delighted to have you as my guest today on the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We've had a few minutes to compare notes as fathers and raising children and so forth in the midst of COVID-19, but we're going to talk about fundraising today. Before we dive into that, how about you just introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yeah, great. Jason, thanks. It's great to be here. Yeah, so I'm Brian Baxter. I work for a company called MAP International, and what we do is we supply medicine and healthcare supplies to people around the world that don't have access to it.
Yeah. So what does that mean? When I'm probably familiar with a number of organizations that do that. So tell me what that means in a, give me, unpack that some more.
Okay. So what we do is we work with pharmaceutical companies. We work with local, or we work with donors of different sorts. And then we have partners all over the world that we send medicine to, that we send healthcare supplies, if it's masks, gloves, that type of thing to. And so we work with them on that to meet the needs of the people that they're working with on the ground in various countries.
Has what MAP does become particularly relevant now in the midst of COVID?
Well, you know, there's nothing like a good pandemic for a health organization to have a spike in interest. So we have had definitely a banner year. There's no question about it. But, you know, we were busy before. So, you know, there's always things that are going on. You know, we work with, you know, with kids, we work with families, we work with moms. We're kind of in all aspects in the health as well as even disaster. You take a pandemic, you throw in Hurricane Laura, you throw in an explosion in Beirut. We've been busy, needless to say.
Yeah, I definitely I definitely get that. So you've been in how long you've been in fundraising, Brian?
So I've been in fundraising about 8 years now.
Yeah, when I completed my first book project, I would often tell people that I was writing to somebody who's about 8 to 10 years in, and the reason I described it that way is because I was always I'm always enjoying conversations with fundraising professionals who are sort of beyond the credentialing and the sort of the breakout sessions at conferences, and they're thinking more critically about their work. So they actually find sort of maybe a multidisciplinary sort of approach, and they're looking at things other than just books about fundraising and stuff. Or is that sort of where you find yourself now?
You know, it definitely is. It's, you know, you kind of get past the 101. You know, when I first got introduced to fundraising, I went to a friend of mine who was at Princeton at the time, and I said, you know, what do I need to know about fundraising? What do I need? And I'm thinking, I need technology. I need all of this stuff. And she goes, right. You need a voice. She said, you need a pen and you need a piece of paper. And that's about it. And I thought, okay, wait, this is a little more simple than I thought. There's got to be more to it than this. And so definitely years later, there's definitely more to it. There's more to uncover. You know, in developing the relationship components with donors and that type of thing, but at the outset, it's pretty simple.
So you reached out with a sort of a question, and you reached out on social media and said, "Hey, I've got this question." I said, "Hey, man, why don't we tackle it sort of as a case study on the podcast?" So why don't you tee that up for us?
Yeah. So you know. What I've been kind of looking at is I've spent the first 7 years or so in fundraising in higher education. And so moving to an NGO like MAP was definitely a different animal. There's no alumni. There's not the opportunity to look at people, potential donors, prospective donors, their majors, things that they were involved with, campus activities, that type of thing. And it's left me with a question of how do you really dive deeper into a donor's passions and interests for your organization when there's not some of the obvious, such as they were a biology major, they were a nursing major, they were a music major, you know, they were in mathematics, they were involved in sports or music, you know, things like that, beyond the obvious. Because honestly, one of the couple of the answers I get are, we love your efficiency, you know, we trust you all with your money, we love just how what you guys do, but they never. I'm finding that it's more of a challenge to get deeper into what all we really do. Like, do the donors really know? You know, they look us up online, we have a great reputation, but they don't dive into more specific, I love helping, you know, children in Guatemala, or I love the work that you guys are doing in Africa, or I love, you know, how you all quickly respond to natural disasters. They focus more a lot of times on the efficiency side. And so diving into and getting into how do we get the bigger dollars when people really like our efficiency?
Well, okay. So help me with that, Brian, because there's two things that you're kind of making me squirm in my seat, because I'm working on a book project right now that's basically an all-out assault on efficiency in the fundraising space. But I also appreciate when someone uses the word love when anytime somebody who's a guest on my podcast or I'm talking to them in person or something, when somebody uses the word love, it really makes my ears perk up, because I think those are the places to go with a donor. So explain to me. Are your donors actually saying, are they actually using those two words together? Or do you think they're just saying that because they really just don't have anything else to say?
Yeah, I think, you know, when you call a donor on the phone, and obviously, you know, you don't have necessarily a set meeting, you're calling to check in on them. And you catch them at a moment, they're not prepared for the conversation. And so you start kind of this awkward conversation. You know, you're trying to kind of break the ice with someone maybe you haven't talked to before. And so I start to ask them, you know, these questions that we know to ask, you know, how to dive deeper into and uncover their passions and their interests and all that in a time where you've caught them off guard. And so they'll say things like, I like, right? Or I love you guys are efficient.
Yeah,
right. Going,
I don't think they love your efficiency.
You literally, they who I'm talking to, they're helping to save kids' lives. They're helping to save mothers' lives by donating in partnering with MAP to provide medicine and health supplies to people all over the world. And they go, I love the efficiency that you guys have. I love that your CEO doesn't make $1 billion. You know, I trust you guys. You have a great reputation. You've got, you know, a great rating online, you know, and I'm going, okay. You know what else we do? You know how impactful you are to people all over the world. And it's sometimes it's a little tough.
Well, okay. So, so I think I'm piecing this together and the idea that you've picked up the telephone and you're perhaps talking to, my guess is they don't have anything else to say. They can sort of grasp, they can kind of grab at something that sort of universally fits, so that you could be MAP, but you could also be the nearby Humane Society or the local rescue mission or something, and they could still say, "I love your efficiency." I sort of get the sense that that's some of what you're picking up on. But yeah. the other question, and I'm taking notes here because I really want to unravel this some more, because like I said, I'm working on a project that really sort of bears down on this notion of efficiency. But is some of the reason why they're saying that they love your efficiency because that's the story you sell them? So what I mean by that is if they got an appeal letter yesterday from you, if they got something in the mail from you, or a newsletter or something, or an email, for example, an e-newsletter, is that notion that your CEO is not getting paid a whole lot? Is that the message that you're essentially selling in everything, in all your communications?
You know, I don't think so. You know, I've only been with MAP just over a year. In fact, it's been a year this week. And sure. So that is not something that I know MAP brags about. We don't go around and we brag about
our efficiency.
Right. No, it's definitely not. And yet I find people that have been with us for 20, 30 years, even have said, "Yo, we love the work that you do. But we love that we know our dollar is going to go the furthest with you guys."
Yeah.
And so
okay.
That's a great compliment, because they trust us and we want to be good stewards with the money that people have entrusted us with, of course, you know. But I want to find more, that I want to uncover more of what is it specific. Are they interested, you know, when natural disasters hit? I mean, ironically, my first day at MAP was Hurricane Dorian, and it hit the Bahamas, and I got to see how our team worked when they were even displaced, because we're based in Georgia and our area was evacuated, even so with the hurricanes. And so I got to see firsthand that end of, you know, how they work. But then I also, I've talked with people and shared with them just about, you know, the places we're at in Africa, the places we're at in Asia, you know, I mean, all over the world, we have partners we're working with in different aspects and providing them the resources that they need. And maybe it's, we have so many things to tell, and, you know, maybe it's our donors just aren't quite sure, what to pick. So that's when they fall on, we know we trust you.
Yeah. So I'm guessing we're primarily talking about you're sort of in a major gifts role type seat when you're talking about these conversations. So you're picking up the telephone or perhaps sitting down with a donor in person over a cup of coffee or whatever, a Zoom meeting, and you're having a conversation that's essentially trying to sort of start that journey to perhaps an upgraded gift. Am I right?
Correct. Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. So, if you don't mind, one of the things I'd like to share with you, and I don't know if you've picked, so in my first book, I talk about these five keywords. And these five keywords is sort of a keyword outline that I oftentimes recommend that organizations use for these initial meetings. So this is essentially this initial conversation. What you're trying to do, Brian, is get on the other side of an initial conversation with a donor for whom you've never had any meaningful engagement with. Am I right?
Correct. Correct.
Yeah. And we have actually, our firm has actually used this outline as a complete alternative to feasibility studies. I'm not a big fan of feasibility studies, but a lot of people sell them to nonprofit organizations as a way to sort of assess the viability of a capital campaign. And I'm like, I don't think that's the type of work we need to be doing. I think we need to be having consistently having conversations like the one we're going to be talking about here. But the first question I like to ask, Brian, I use the keyword vision. If you can get this individual on the phone and you can ask them, what would be your, so Mr. and Mrs. Smith, what would be your vision for the organization 5 years out? What do you think they would tell you?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I think that's one of the things that I'm trying to uncover. And maybe that for me, part of it is being new to the organization, or it's being new to a different type of fundraising, if you will, other than or outside of education, where it seems like so many of the things were very obvious.
Okay, so going back to your previous work in another organization, if you had asked that of a donor in your first meeting, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, what's your vision for the organization 5 years out? Would they have been able to answer that question?
I feel like they would have. They had relationships with the previous university I was at. They had relationships with faculty, with staff. They were more engaged in that aspect. You know, there was more things that they were a part of oftentimes.
Yeah.
And so for instance, I was working on building a biology endowment. And so I could go to a number of our alumni that had been, had gone pre-med, you know, they were doctors of various sorts, and pitch this idea to them of contributing to building out an endowment for this particular major. And they could see that, and they could look at the university and they could see, okay, you guys are going in this direction. And
yeah.
That was the obvious. It was fairly obvious there. So.
Yeah. Okay. So we've done this with clients. We do what's called we've called it a tour almost. And we basically, we'll sit to, I worked with one client for several years and we took the same keyword outline and we just basically asked these same five questions of as many donors as would sit down and meet with us as an alternative to a traditional feasibility study sort of approach. And Brian, what we arrived at was a lot of people couldn't answer the question. So they basically answered the question with very vague responses, kind of like you're getting inadvertently without even asking this question. But there were plenty of people who would have basically said, you know, I can think of several conversations where when you ask the question, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, what's your vision of the organization 5 years out? They would say, just keep doing what you're doing and keep doing it really well. So they didn't really have an answer. And I suspect that that's the type of response you would get from a lot of these from the donors that you're talking to at MAP right now. The second question we always ask is how is the organization meeting or exceeding or perhaps not meeting your expectations? What do you think your current donors would say to that?
You know, I think they would say that we are continuing to meet their expectation because we are, they trust us. We're very responsible with the donations, with the money that they give. They get reports back so they can see, you know, through annual reports and various reports that we put together and send out throughout the year. I think that's what that they oftentimes would say.
Do you think any of them would be so bold as to tell you on the telephone, for example? I mean, most of the time we're doing these meetings in person, and I would certainly suggest using Zoom for a conversation like this, perhaps. But do you think some of your donors would be so bold as to tell you where you're not meeting their expectations, and any idea where that might would be?
To me, I'm a firm believer in you know, the honesty. Let's you know, if you're investing in some dollar, if you're investing dollars, if you are helping to provide resources to my organization, you're kind of, so to speak, you're the boss, so to speak.
Yeah.
You know, because I want to know, as someone who is responsible for working with that person, I want to know how I can best meet their expectations. But I think, honestly, I think most donors, for the most part, are afraid of that. Now, maybe it's your top tier, your very top tier donors that are, you know, dropping the really large gifts versus your smaller donors that are making, you know, your kind of your mid-level and even some of your higher, but lower top tier donors. I don't know that they would be so bold or is so honest to say, you know, they didn't like something.
Yeah. So we have uncovered in using this exercise that often now let me also clarify too. We send these questions in advance. So, for example, Mr. and Mrs. Smith would have gotten a short letter, 3-paragraph letter. I'll be happy to send you a copy of a sample of the letter. But essentially, they get a letter ahead of time and they say, "We'd like to have this conversation. We're having this conversation with 100 of our donors." And so they get a chance to sort of noodle over it ahead of time. And I think that may be part of what do any of these people I'm assuming you're describing in most cases don't know that you're calling. Am I right?
Correct. Yeah. It's definitely something I like to try to do, you know, but, with my particular, you know, caseload, oftentimes I can't give them, I'm not able to give them necessarily a heads up, or maybe it's, I don't have an email address or, you know, something of the sort.
Yeah. So what you may actually do, and I'll keep walking you through this line of questions, but what you may actually want to do, Brian, is when you get them on the phone in this situation, don't try to, you may be trying too hard to have a conversation at the wrong time. And so you might simply say on the telephone, "Hey, I'm just reaching out to ask you if we can have a follow-up conversation to this, just reaching out, introducing myself. You're probably not prepared for a meaningful conversation." Because I feel like that's sort of what you're grasping for, and I don't think you're going to get it in that. I don't think you're going to get it.
Right.
And so perhaps, and this is why we send the letter out, for example. So you send this letter out, you explain to them that you're going to ask them 5 questions. These 5 questions are going to guide our conversation, and then they can noodle on the ideas and the opinions that they have over, you know, in advance of the call. And then we schedule it. And I think that's probably what's caught getting in your way. The third question, Brian, that we ask always has to do with confidence. And again, as you're sort of unpacking these, you may find that your people just don't know you that well. But to find out that they don't know you that well is also, to me, an indicator that you're not going to get their most meaningful gifts.
Right.
If you just can't grab their heart, if they just don't give a damn, you're not going to get them to – they've got somebody else they love more than you, right? So the third question is always confidence. And – this is where you get them to answer whether they're confident in the organization, perhaps your CEO, perhaps your board, and perhaps your strategic plan. But I'm guessing when you're talking to Mr. and Mrs. Smith in this format you're talking about, they probably would not give you a whole lot of – you're probably not expecting much substance there either. Am I right?
Correct. Yeah. I mean, again, that's the thing that I've definitely learned in the last year being at MAP is that people value, you know, where their money is going. That's not something I had really heard much before I came to MAP. You have people constantly praising how they trust us as an organization, how they, you know, they love the work that we're doing from kind of the 1,000-foot view.
Yeah.
But, you know, if I can speak to this, you know, one of the things that drew me into MAP is I'm a dad. I have a daughter who has epilepsy. You know, and so if you call me up on the phone and there's, you know, talking about kids or talking about medical conditions, that really resonates with me. You know, that's something that really grabs me. And, but that's, I think that's one of the things, like, I know kind of my story, like why I support the organization I work for is because I know what it's like to be that parent that, you know, I found out that, you know, the medication that my daughter needed wasn't covered by insurance. And you know, I live in America. I happen to have a credit card. And, you know, I'm sitting there and I tell people this, but, you know, I remember sitting at a Walgreens on a Friday night at 10 p.m. And the doctor said, or the pharmacist said, hey, you know, your medicine's not covered by your insurance. And I just came from a week and, you know, 3 or 4 days in the hospital with my daughter. And, but, you know, when you think outside of the U.S., people don't have access to that. They don't have a 24-hour pharmacy. They don't have an ER that they can just walk into. It, so to speak, the rules are different. You know, the situations are different. And so my story why I'm so big on what we do is because I see that difference. I remember what it was like being that parent. But I think a lot of times people will see the work that the organization does from the higher level viewpoint, you know, from the thousands.
But I don't know. Okay. So, I grew up having, coincidentally, Brian, I don't think you and I knew that, we didn't know this. I grew up with seizures myself and I worked at the Epilepsy Foundation for a couple of years.
Okay.
So I can certainly appreciate your concerns, and my son has a seizure condition as well. And we're very fortunate, both of us, to take meds that are relatively inexpensive and easily accessible. So I can certainly appreciate where you're coming from. But I think, so the fourth question on this list that we ask, which may actually be helpful, the fourth question we always ask these folks, Brian, is what other organizations do you support? And it may be interesting for you to, if you got on the phone with some of these donors. So if I had gotten on the phone with you, for example, and I'm representing MAP, but I had the audacity in that initial conversation to ask you what other types of organizations do you support, you perhaps may have said that we support the, you know, the Epilepsy Foundation for your, you know, the, say, the local chapter or the national organizations or some other sort of research organization, for example, in the epilepsy community. But what that allows me to do is not necessarily to think. I think some people hesitate to have these conversations because the competitiveness of sort of having to have a conversation about another organization, but it allows you to start to piece together the story. I mean, if you think about what we've done now in the last 25 minutes is I'm essentially getting to know you, Brian, and starting to piece together your story, just like you would want to do as a major gifts officer. Right. You following my thinking here?
Absolutely, yeah.
So we always ask, So I was working with a private school for a while up in doing this particular sort of approach. But we would sit down with people, and if we weren't getting much out of those first three questions, by the time we got to the place where there was some level of rapport, so we were comfortable in the conversation, and then you ask them to talk about the other organizations that they support, sometimes they really come alive. I mean, you just sort of pulled back the curtain on something that was very personal to you, something that as a father matters a whole heck of a lot. And we're talking about your child now. And so what I'm able to do from a fundraising posture is start to piece together your story and perhaps find that place where my story or our story at the organization sort of blends with your story. I think ultimately that's what you're looking for. And I don't know that you're teeing up the conversations well enough to sort of find where those stories are going to connect. That's ultimately what we're getting at here, is we're trying to get the donor to basically tell you their giving story and why they give to you. You're just basically saying, I'm going to give you a set of questions that sort of allows you to be an open book, and I'm going to look for places to connect the dots. Does that make sense?
Completely. Yeah. Yeah. No, I love how you said that. They're giving story. I look at what is their kind of their map story, you know, what is their interest, but it may be taking a step back or kind of an end around approach to uncover, you know, what really moves them about our organization more beyond our efficiency, you know, how they're treated and respected, that type of thing.
Well, it's interesting that I've got a great book in front of me. It's written by a guy named John Kay, and the subtitle is Why Our Goals Are Better Achieved Indirectly. John Kay was the big at Cambridge for a long time. I'll send you a link to the book. But one of the things, so when we're talking, I told you earlier that I'm studying up in order to really sort of hammer down on efficiency. Most of the time when we're thinking about efficiency, we're thinking in a very linear way and we're thinking very direct. And what you just said is the key word that we as fundraisers have got to get comfortable with, is we've got to get comfortable with that indirect route, which oftentimes doesn't feel very efficient. And so you're thinking, and perhaps your board and your boss are thinking, that if you pick up the telephone, you're expected to go from A to B to C in a very linear fashion. And that's what efficiency is. In fact, you guys are selling efficiency to your people, when in fact, what you need to do is have a somewhat indirect route, something like this line of questions that I'm asking, but essentially arrives more effectively at what it is you're trying to do.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I know one of the things, you know, is a fundraiser that I never want to, I don't mind discussing, but, you know, I know it doesn't move the needle for people, is that conversation about efficiency and stewardship. Those are all things that, I mean, you know, I think you and I can agree that we should expect that from any organization that we give a nickel to. You know, I mean, I'm the guy that if I see someone stand on the corner raising money for cancer research, I want to know how much of my dollar is going to their lunch. I mean, I'm that guy, you know. Those are things I think we should just naturally expect. You know, people should value, people should, you know, should trust on that. But getting to that next level, especially where it's not so obvious, like I said, my background being in education, where it wasn't their particular major, the activities they were involved with on campus, those are often fairly obvious places to start, you know, beloved professors and that type of thing. I'm definitely finding it to be a good challenge, but a challenge nonetheless.
I can't think of an organization that's going to put, you know, any organization that ends up in my mailbox today that wants to ask me for $100, I'm going to assume is relatively efficient at what they do. They effectively accomplish their goals and they're good stewards of the resources that they give me, you know, that right. I give them. Yeah. I don't think your donors are giving to you. I I don't think, I could be wrong, but I don't think your organizations are giving to you because they love your efficiency. I think in some ways you're perhaps sort of cracking the egg on or opening up a can of worms on the reality that you may be interacting with a donor who doesn't engage with you enough to sort of know how to articulate in much more meaningful ways, but you're not going to be able to get them there until you get to the place, like you just shared with me about your daughter and her seizure condition. Until you get to a place like that, you're not going to be able to help the donor, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, sort of connect the dots to what is more meaningful for them to what it is that you do. Because it sounds like you're such a if you're such an organization that's doing things on a global scale, and if you're in the healthcare world, you know, if you're essentially distributing medication, for example, to all parts of the world for all sorts of concerns, no wonder efficiency is all they grab for, because you've got to connect. You've got to connect something more. You got to get deeper.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's something that some of my colleagues we're continuing to work on and is more of the specific things that we are involved with. You know, really getting those stories from the field and the programs, the more specific programs that we're doing, that we're involved with, that we are raising the funds for, that we're shipping medications to, that we're shipping, you know, health supplies to, that type of thing. We're in the process of really trying to articulate that more, because that's been one of the questions I've had, is do people really know what all we do? Like, they know we provide medicine and health supplies, but getting down to, you know, do they have a love for? I spoke with a donor not too long ago and found out that they had an interest in Guatemala. Well, they found out they had an interest in Guatemala because I was sharing with them, just so happened I sent them a piece on this program that we are working on in Guatemala, and it's providing medicine to kids there. And just so happened they adopted a child from Guatemala in the last couple of years, and it really resonated with them. And it was, oh, wow, you know, the light went off. But then there's plenty of
others. Did the light go off for them, or did the light go off for you?
I think it was both, because one, they, you know, they didn't know that we had a program there that they could get behind. And I didn't know that they had adopted a child from there, you know, in just the last few years.
Okay, but that's the key. The child that they adopted from Guatemala is the same, quote unquote, the same as your daughter with a seizure condition. That's the part of the story that's essentially going to connect the dots between what it is your organization does and why that matters to your donor. And I think I think the other thing that I'm picking up on, Brian, is I think when you pick up the phone, you're still in what I call lane one. So a lot of people who watch me talk, you know, the things that I talk about on social media, I talk about these three lanes. And I think you're having these essentially consumer-oriented sort of sales pitch type conversations that we oftentimes get very comfortable with. Educating our donors is oftentimes the language that gets sort of tossed around in this context.
Sure.
Your donors are already beyond that. And so if they're consistently responding to your appeals, if they're giving you, you know, if this family gave you, you know, $500, $1,000 a year for the last 3 or 4 years, you don't really have to sell them on who you are. In order to get to a much more meaningful level of support, you're going to have to sort of move it beyond the sales pitch. And that's oftentimes going to mean you've got to get it away from, you've got to get it to a much more deeper, they're talking about this in the consumer sciences. I was just reading this yesterday. So we as consumers in a society, hyper-connected society, where we can buy everything that we possibly want on Amazon, for example, is sort of getting to the place where the things we can buy in a mass market, like like Amazon is sort of losing its meaning. And so we're looking for places where we're looking for things that we can buy that are much more intimate, that have much greater meaning, and we'll pay remarkably more dollars for them. But in actual value, they're, you know, perhaps pennies compared to what, you know, a product on the shelf at a department store might be worth. And it's because we're looking for that deeper meaning. It's what one author talks about, sort of this difference between sort of moving from this sort of monoculture consumer mindset to a much more knowledge-based consumer who, if you can't give them something that's of greater depth and meaning, they're not going to buy it from you.
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
I mean, you can go to Walmart right now and you're going to see words like efficiency and effectiveness on all sorts of products on their box. And you'll buy that, and every other consumer will buy that. But your donors, but I think a lot of our donors that are stuck in these, what I call lane one fundraising, these shallow fundraising activities, are sort of getting weary of that stuff. And what you're trying to do, what your employer is paying you to do, is your employer is saying, reach out to these select few, engage them in some sort of meaningful way, and perhaps raise their expectation of us so we can in turn raise our expectation of them.
Yeah, that makes sense. Is it, in a way, in a roundabout way, is it almost like saying, you know, speaking of products, like the word's natural. Natural's posted on everything anymore, right? And it's like, well, of course it is. It came from the ground or whatever. Something is natural that's in it. Maybe it's just certain words maybe are just being thrown around more.
Well, it's that they're going. They don't want to buy commodities anymore. Is essentially what this author's talking about. People don't, because we've got enough stuff. We've got enough stuff, and when it comes to fundraising, we've got another charity in our mailbox tomorrow if we choose not to give to you today. And so, if we don't make a more meaningful connection with these people, and I think this is the greatest risk that a lot of us have got to be thinking about. And I'm getting on my soapbox here, so please forgive me. But I think in this sort of this hyper-connected world where we can do so much communication via platforms like you and I have here today, we're at risk of sort of over-commodifying what it is we do in fundraising to the point where you can't even get to the place where you're at with some of these donors because there's so many other organizations all across the planet trying to do the same thing.
We're losing the really personal side of what we do sometimes.
Well, and Brian, isn't it the real personal place where we actually start? Let's just be real here. The brass tacks of this is that, isn't it, once you get to that personal side of this stuff where we actually start making a margin on the money that we're raising?
Yeah.
The thing is about lane one fundraising is it's all well and good and it makes the donor feel all warm and fuzzy, but oftentimes that particular fundraising effort is costing us so much money that we don't make a significant margin on it. It's the reason we pay a gift officer like yourself, but you can't use the same tools. And this gets back to the idea, you can't pick up the phone and use the same tools that we were using to get them in the first place.
Right, right. Yeah, I would agree, yeah. At some point, we've got to go beyond that.
The last question we ask in this outline, for the sake of our listeners, somebody's going to probably say, why didn't you finish this outline that you started with Brian on? So the last question we ask is there any one thing that we don't know? It's a very open-ended question, but it's kind of like getting at this idea of your daughter has a seizure condition or your son, you know, you adopted your son from Guatemala. Is there anything about you or our organization, it doesn't have to be good or bad, but is there anything, what you're doing is at the back end of this conversation, you're sort of leaving this wide open door for them to just tell you anything they want to tell you. And the hope is oftentimes that after talking to them for 45 minutes, because that's oftentimes what ends up happening in this very, using this outline, is they'll tell you all sorts of crazy things.
Yeah, they
will
just.
Is there any one thing we don't know?
Yeah, that's something I hadn't thought about. like it's something that I want to know. Yeah, I want you know, anyone that I'm talking with in person, you know, on the phone, face to face, whatever that looks like, Zoom, you know, these days, even I want them to feel like they can share with me whatever they're thinking about, you know, but it's getting there. It's as you're talking about with this outline, and it's getting to that place. Let me ask you this, you know, with the turnover that we see in fundraising, do you think any of this that plays a part in it? So I'm new to MAP, you know, I don't know how many gift officers that Mrs. Smith had before me. Do you think that, because I know I would think for a donor, that would get old after a while, like I got to start this thing over again, you know? So, but is there a level of comfortability that you get to because there's been a sustained relationship over X amount of time, whatever that is, essentially for the donor to feel comfortable really sharing with this person? So now it's not just they have a relationship with the organization, but there's also the relationship with the fundraiser that's on the phone with them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It absolutely has everything to do with the rapid turnover on the part of our donors. But I think it all absolutely has to do with the donor attrition that we see. I think donor attrition, the donors not renewing their support, and the rapid turnover that we see in your roles like yours are essentially two sides of the same coin. What you're seeing is you're seeing relationships that are not being strategically and appropriately teed up so as to not have to have this conversation every 18 months. Because you're right, I'm never going to recommend to a client that they have this conversation every time, every 18 months, every time they hire a new Brian. What I'm saying to a client is not every time you hire a Brian, but I'm saying as you try to move a relationship from what I call lane one to a relationship in lane two, which is that messy, unpredictable space between these relatively shallow relationships and these most significant relationships, you need to have these conversations. So it's sort of like the conversation after the first date, right? So you and your wife went on a first date and the first date plays out the way it does. But after you go on that first date, the second relationship, the second time you get together, oftentimes sort of begins to creep on much more meaningful, much more substantial sort of things, right? You're starting to have much more meaningful conversations. And so I think what I've observed in doing this with clients and doing this with their donors is that organizations aren't having this conversation ever with their donors. I don't want you to have it two or three times. I just want you to, at least as an organization, commit to having it once. Does that make sense?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And I think guys like you, to sort of finalize this thought, I think guys like you who want to find joy in meaning and want to be assured that you're going to be in this job 18, 24, 36 months from now, want to start in a place like this as well. If you don't start having these conversations with these donors in some sort of fashion like I'm describing, you're not going to be there in 24 months either. And so what we need to do is we need to get you started off on the right foot, get the relationship with the donor started off on the right foot. And then instead of you being gone in 18 months, you're actually asking for a much more meaningful gift in 18 months.
Right. Right. Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense there too. It's interesting. One of the things that I had learned, you know, years back, good note taking, you know, and having a CRM that really works, you know, in making sure that people are continuing to put their information in there, what they learn from donor conversations, donor communications, you know, email, phone call, in person, whatever that looks like. But continue to make sure to update that information so that the conversation doesn't have to start over when somebody leaves, if it's in 18 months or if it's in 10 years. So that for the donor's sake, they're not starting this whole thing over again by having to regurgitate the information that they shared, you know, 12 months or 2 years ago with somebody.
See, I'm pushing back. I mean, I'm a fan of, I could tell you a couple of CRM products that I'm excited about, but I'm pushing against some of this consumer science sort of stuff. I think fundraising has been sort of informed by PR and marketing and advertising all within the consumer space for so long that a guy like you and I cannot have a conversation with it without essentially referring to a donor as if they're a consumer who's buying products at Walmart.
Right.
And that's essentially, in my mind, what you're describing. You're talking about a CRM that can capture data so as to manipulate that relationship 18 months or 10 years down the road. And I think we've got to change. I don't think donors want to be viewed as consumers. I think donors want to be viewed as partners, as citizens, as friends. What I think you could put any number of things, but I think if you called up your donors and you asked them, what sort of frame of reference do you want us to give when we think about how we interact with you? They're not going to say, interact with me like a consumer. And that's what the CRM world is essentially doing, is they're trying to create mass numbers of consumers so as to manipulate a particular population of individuals to, you know, they're commodifying it. And that's okay. And when I say okay, I guess it's, I sort of tolerate it. But when you move into this inner lane, this middle lane of relationships, we're talking about 100 people that you don't have to get all that hung up about what sort of data goes in that CRM, because these are real, genuine relationships. And ideally, you're not going to go anywhere. And ideally, they're not going to go anywhere either.
Yeah.
Brian, you and I know enough about you in this conversation here in 45 minutes. I'm not putting your name in a CRM, but you and I could meet 3 weeks from now and we could start the conversation exactly where we stop it today.
Yeah, it's more of a
it's real relationships.
Yeah, that's it. That's is a guy I recently heard on a podcast. He said, "You know, talk to people like humans."
Yes. Like, quit talking to them like the way Walmart does, and start talking to them like, does your doctor, okay, I mean, obviously your doctor has to put data in a database, or your attorney or something, but think about the people in your life that you regularly interact with, professionally or personally or somewhere in between. Do they actually get all that hung up about the data that they put in a database, or do they basically sort of know that I can have this sort of circle of relationships? There's an author, Robin Dunbar, says that we can have about 150 of these in our life at any given time. It's sort of the peak on the number of relationships that Facebook figures out are actually real, meaningful relationships. You can have about 150 of these, and your brain, your God-given brain, is perfectly capable of sort of managing the information for these 150 relationships. Organizations have got to be committed to forming those types of relationships, and we're not.
Yeah, I completely agree. That's something, you know, that's part of what drew me into this, the whole fundraising bit, is I am a connector. I'm a natural connector. I value people, relationships over, you know, most things. The trust of somebody, winning that trust and having that real authentic relationship, to where, you know, I tell people, you know, you can call me and curse at me, or you can call me and you know, tell me you've had the best day of your life. I just want you to be real and honest and authentic.
And yeah, so I'm going to be real honest and authentic. I got to let you go so I can take my kid to work. My wife just texted me and she said, "Jason, you got to get off the podcast and start to get ready to take your kid to work." But Brian, this has been a real conversation. I've really enjoyed it. If there's anybody that's listening today and they want to reach out to you and they want to say, "Hey, I've got some other insight for Brian to consider," or "I want to ask Brian some questions," how would you suggest that they do that?
You can find me on LinkedIn, of course. You can look up Brian Baxter, and that's Baxter. There's probably 100 of us, but I'm actually located in the Oklahoma City metro area. So you can find me that way. You can also email me at bbaxter@map.org. those are probably the two best and easiest ways to reach me.
Brian, it has certainly been a pleasure. I'm going to get my kid to work. You have a wonderful day, and we'll have you back sometime real soon.
All right. That sounds great, Jason. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.